Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Tilt UK.
Hello, you're listening to Tilt at the Mill, and I'm Mark Thompson here with you for the next hour or so. Coming up, I'll be joined by Tim Worthington to discuss TV remakes over the years in the light of the news that the classic BBC sitcom Are You Being Served is being remade. And then later, I'll be talking to Labour activist Emma Burnell about the new politics and why some politicians appear to be struggling with it. We'll also touch upon the latest in the EU referendum campaign. If you want to get in touch, we're on Twitter, at TiltUK, or I'm at Mark Reckins. You can tweet me your thoughts. You can also email me on markreckons@live.co.uk, and we'll start with TV remakes after this.
Ground floor perfumery, stationery and leather goods, wigs and haberdashery, kitchenware and food going
up. Hi, it's Mark Thompson, Tilt at the Mill here. Some listeners of an older vintage might recognise the music we're playing here. It's the theme music from Are You Being Served, which, in my opinion, is the best thing about that sitcom, the theme music. But the fact that that's being remade at the moment has led us to think we should maybe have a little look back at some of the other TV remakes that have happened over the years. And I'm joined by a friend of the show, Tim Worthington, who's going to talk to us about various remakes from over the years. Good evening, Tim.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
No problem. It should say as well that today there's been another remake announced. Well, not it's already been announced, but they released a photo today of a very old-looking Michael Crawford being led round on roller skates.
Oh, yeah.
It caused a lot of alarm because it looks very alarming.
Yeah, that's for sport relief. It's only going to be a little five-minute thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true, yes.
Yeah, but even so, you know, I think it's 1978, the last time that him and Michelle Dotrice did the thing on UK television with Frank Spencer and all the rest of it. So, I don't know how that's going to go. And I don't know how the Are You Being Served one's going to go either. But we already know how some went over the years, didn't we?
Yes. I mean, it's not very often that people manage to get it right. They manage to bring something back and for it to work again. Because quite often, you know, these shows were a product of their times and they caught on because they chimed with how people felt at the time. I mean, even if you look at, people might say, well, what about the Likely Lads and what happened to the Likely Lads? And they're really two different programmes. You know, they're almost, in the way sort of the characters have matured between them, they're almost different characters. And most other revivals, when they bring them back, they just keep things exactly as they were, and it generally doesn't work.
I mean, I think I've only ever seen Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads. I don't think I've ever seen the original, because, like you say, the original was, what, 10, 15 years early and was in black and white, and I couldn't relate to that at all. I could barely relate to the one set in the 70s, to be honest. But, I take what you mean about it being a very different thing.
Yeah, I mean, the original's a lot more like basically a kitchen sink drama with jokes in, you know, the sort of lads on the town, you know, sort of not quite Bath in the front room. You know, they've moved on a bit from them, but it's very sort of, you know, grimy but fun, you know, like most people's lives would be around that time. And then in the early 70s, living in semis and looking for a better life. And
But that was one of those ones that had a weird remake of a remake, didn't it? Because was it a one-off special with Ant and Dec where they recreated, I think, what is the episode that most people remember, which is the one where the two characters are running around town trying to avoid finding the football result out, and
yeah,
Brian Glover was chasing after them in the original. In the remake, I think it was John Thompson.
It was, yeah, No Hiding Place, the episode's called.
That's it.
Why that was a good idea, why anyone thought it was a good idea, I don't know, because the immediate thing you think about it is, even then, even 10 years ago, did anyone wait for the football highlights?
Yeah,
it was just about possible to watch it live on your phone in those days.
I mean, it would be hopelessly anachronistic now, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, and also, Ant and Dec, you know, they are very talented, but they need their own vehicle, really. Well, I say that, but they made that terrible film, Alien Autopsy. But why would they take on something that's so well-loved and so well-known? Because there was no way they could make that their own. There was no way they could better it. It was almost a shot-for-shot remake. And, yeah, a very bad idea, but at least people remember it, you can say that.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe we can put that in the bad column, then. What about some good stuff?
Well, I would immediately point to, it was only last year, the remake of The Clangers. Well, I say The Clangers. The programme was... The original was actually just called Clangers.
Mm.
But that was a very, very carefully done attempt to keep the distinctive flavour of the original series while looking new. So they used stop-motion animation like the original series, but with new techniques. So it looked perfectly modern, perfectly acceptable for its target audience now, which really is, you know, it's children under five, it's not me. But it had still had that weird, that spacey, anachronistic look that the original had. And as well as that, you know, they very carefully, they got Michael Palin into the race. It was an ideal choice. They got John Dupre to do a very close approximation of the original music, but in, you know, with his own musical themes and so on. And I also, most of the scripts were written by Daniel Postgate, who's Oliver Postgate's son, with Dave Ingham, who he's written hundreds of modern children's animations like Charlie and Lola, Bob the Builder, Bear Behaving Badly, things like that. So it was really a perfect combination of old and new. They struck the balance perfectly on every level, and it really, really worked. And one very clever thing they did was they didn't just show the series in isolation. Sort of, it kind of interacted with the CBBC presenters. You know, they'd be looking through a telescope and see the Clangers and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So it really, while it was very true to the original series, they found very clever ways of bringing it into the modern viewing experience. That really, really worked, I thought.
Hmm. Okay. What about... Because, I mean, something like, say, The Prisoner, which is obviously, you know, an absolute classic that, you know, lots of people remember. And it was actually broadcast the original before I was even born, but I've watched every single episode of it, and I know lots of people over the years have as well. And they attempted to remake that a few years ago. I think I managed to get through about two episodes of the remake before I just gave up, because it just wasn't working for me.
Well, that's the key thing, because most people have actually forgotten it happened, and it's only 2009 it was on.
Now,
it wasn't that long ago at all, but it was just a complete disaster, because there had been previous attempts in other media at reviving The Prisoner. I mean, there's some spin-off novels where very odd things happened, like Number Six leaves the village and then he goes on holiday to Port Merion in one of them, which is quite an interesting twist on it. And there was a DC comic series which actually got the thumbs up from Patrick McGowan, where it was set sort of a bit in the future with an elderly Number Six refusing to leave the village, even though he was the only person still there.
Mm.
So obviously people in the past had thought, well, because it's so odd, because it's so offbeat, we need to do something different if we're bringing it back. But AMC, who make a lot of good programmes, I think it was a co-production with ITV, but they basically just turned it into a typical weird mainstream drama. I mean, too much was explained, too many rationalisations. It's interesting to compare to, around the same time, ITV wanted to bring back another sort of very odd sci-fi series called Sapphire and Steel.
Mm.
And they were at quite an advanced stage, and the writer, PJ Hammond, pulled out of it and withdrew the rights because they said there had to be an origin episode explaining who Sapphire and Steel were. And I interviewed him a couple of years ago, and as he said to me, well, you can't explain who they are because they just are.
Yeah.
And the revival of The Prisoner was like that. It tried to explain why people didn't know they were in the village, you know, why the village existed. That wasn't the point of
the whole point is you don't know.
Yes, exactly. He doesn't know, you know.
Mm.
And he's not on the quest to find out, he's just on the quest to get out.
Mm.
So it was very, very dull, really.
Yeah, Sapphire and Steel used to really freak me out when I was a kid. I still remember one episode, I think it was someone standing on stairs and they were in a house but there were no windows and they couldn't get out. I was only about five. It really, really scarred me.
About the man with no face who's in every photograph.
Hmm.
Maybe he's in the photograph with you, he can control you, yes.
Maybe
I was terrified by that.
Well, maybe it's a good thing that's not getting remade,
yeah.
let's just say. I mean, what about something like, I remember the original of this. I do remember watching this when it was first on The Professionals. And I remember, was it Sky did a reboot of that? It was kind of like The Professionals, The Next Generation.
Yeah, it's called CI-5, The New Professionals. I think that was in about 1999. But it was nothing like the original Professionals in anything but name. And the fact they were sort of, you know, rough, tough intelligence agents, because the whole reason I think the original was a success was it was of the time that's gone now, I mean, there was a very sort of very good Comic Strip Presents episode where they parodied the whole thing of the, you know, the sort of grimy boozer Docklands setting of the professionals.
Mm.
They run into the Docklands, it's all gleaming office blocks and so on, and they're, they're terrified and they don't know what's happened. For better or for worse, the whole point of it was, you know, very macho, very, you know, the women knew their place and the men blew things up. But the CI5, the new professionals, had a sort of, I'm not saying this is necessarily a bad thing, but it's a bad thing if you're doing the professionals, had a mixed gender cast and was in touch with its feminine side, really.
I suppose they sort of have to do that, though, don't they, when they bring these things back,
they
especially...
have to, but it would be advisable to do a completely new series.
Yeah.
Rather than have one where people just think, well, what's the point of that?
Yeah, I can see that. So maybe that's another one that didn't work. What about some more that you think did work, then?
Well, Battlestar Galactica, which I don't know if a lot of people will have seen. The original Battlestar Galactica was a sort of Me Too Star Wars TV series, very heavily skewed towards merchandise sales rather than, you know, plot or anything like that.
Yeah, there seemed to be a lot of stuff kind of in the late 70s, early 80s, kind of piggybacking off Star Wars. Buck Rogers, for example, that was another one that kind of sticks in my mind.
There were times that the original Battlestar Galactica made Buck Rogers look intellectual. But the remake very, very cleverly took... There are some disturbing ideas under the original plot of Battlestar Galactica, which, you know, is about mankind being hunted to extinction.
Mm.
And they really rebuilt it around all of that, and very carefully did things. Like, some of the major characters were recast as female. I mean, one thing that gets forgotten is the original did have a female lead in it, who was a starship pilot called Athena. But unfortunately, let's just say the actress who played her wasn't very experienced, so she gets forgotten about a lot. But, although it was based on the original Battlestar Galactica, they sort of drew a line under it and started again. Except there were some very clever nods to the original series. Like, there's a scene where one of the old Cylon costumes is in the museum. The Cylons were the main aliens in it.
Yeah.
They used the original series theme music during ceremonial occasions. They have Daggets, which are the alien dogs, running about, but they don't make them part of cutesy plots in it, which was a blessing, really.
Mm. So you think that's one that did work? Maybe they were able to kind of take some of the original themes and... I mean, Starbuck in the original, who's one of the main characters, kind of fighter pilot, was played by Dirk Benedict, obviously a man. And in the remake, I can't remember what the actress's name is, but it's certainly a woman. So that was kind of an example of where they took one of the primary characters that was male in the original and made it female in the remake.
Yes, yeah. And Boomer as well was female in the remake, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those ones. I stuck with that for maybe a couple of seasons, but in the end, I sort of got a little bit tired of it. It felt a little bit samey to me in the end. I understand what you mean about one of those ones that, you know, was maybe more successful. I certainly remember lots of people talking about it and seeing a lot about it on Twitter, etc., but maybe just didn't quite work for me, but then the original probably wouldn't have worked for me either.
Well, possibly not. But it's interesting that to compare it to another successful revival, which I never thought would come back at all, which is Doctor Who, which, of course, has been going for over 10 years now.
It's weird to hear you say as well that you never thought it would come back, because when you look at it now, it's such a phenomenal success as a remake. It may even be the most successful remake or reboot in television history, because it's just absolutely huge. Kids are into it, adults are into it. I can't really imagine a Michael Grade of the future cancelling it, certainly not in the next 5 or 10 years.
No, well, hopefully not, but I think there's a very good reason for that, which is, I mean, I thought it'd never come back because they tried it, obviously, with Paul McGann in the mid-90s, and it didn't take off. But it's interesting to compare that was a revival that came from on high.
Mm.
A couple of people very high up, including Steven Spielberg, said, yeah, this is a good idea, let's bring it back. And it pandered too much to, you know, what was seen to be, you know, an ideal way of making something. It gave too much room to what the fans wanted and so on. Russell T. Davis was someone who started in the very bottom rung of television. You know, famously, he was an artist on Play School. They keep showing clips of him on things. And he worked his way up doing programmes he can't have enjoyed doing. And all the time at the back of his mind must have been, because, you know, he's an obsessive Doctor Who fan, must have thought, I want to get to the point where I can bring that back. And when he brought it back very much from underneath, you know, through BBC Wales, having to, you know, the fight was upwards rather than downwards.
Mm.
And I think during all that time, he got a very real sense of how he could present it to, you know, the ordinary viewer. Because if you ask me, and, you know, yes, this is a bit pot kettle thing, because I would have been part of all that, but the fans have got too much control of it while it was off the air. You know, it being remade in the image of these fans who, you know, let's face it, they were getting older and older and further away from what the target audience of Doctor Who should be. And his response to that was just to do away with it. And, you know, it begins with completely new Doctor, new character, new scenario. He says Gallifrey's being destroyed, that sort of thing. Very few references to the original series in the first run with Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah. That, more and more as the run went on, and, you know, the more and more series, they started to do more and more back referencing, didn't they?
Yes, yeah. Some people think it's a good thing, some think it's a bad thing. Difficult to say, really, because it's the sort of programme where you've got to try and keep every sort of potential audience interested, and I don't imagine that's a very easy task. I think there's probably a lot of juggling involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, though, with Doctor Who, I mean, it was almost the way you've described Russell T Davies kind of, you know, set his original premise for the original reboot series in 2005. He was kind of able to do that pretty seamlessly because already it had been established that the character of the Doctor could regenerate. And, of course, if we're coming to him, you know, many years on from the previous one, it would have been expected he would have gone through more regenerations. So I suppose that was kind of ready-made for him, but things like the assistants are always female nowadays, and there's almost a kind of, you know, I mean, it depends who the doctor is and who the female assistant is, but sometimes there's a bit of a kind of will-they-won't-they thing. Probably not between Peter Capaldi and Louise Coleman, but, you know, maybe some of the other ones.
Yeah.
And that never really used to happen. He was a bit... He used to be more otherworldly, my feeling is, more alien, really, and that the assistants... there was never that question, really, if I'm remembering correctly, anyway.
No, I think that's absolutely true, and I think also there's an extent to which the assistants become more the mysterious, the alien ones in the last couple of years, which I'm not saying isn't for me, but there are still large numbers of people watching and enjoying and not questioning that, so...
Mm.
I'm happy to accept that I'm in the minority there.
Mm. So, I mean, obviously there's been lots and lots of remakes over the years, but one that sticks in my mind, which I'm glad, actually, because you sent me your thoughts before before we came on air, and I know this one leapt out at me, actually, because I was obsessed with this programme when I was a kid. Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, which some people might recognise the theme tune to, from the original one from 1971. That was, I mean, the premise of that programme was two detectives, one's killed in the pilot episode, but then he comes back as a ghost and only his partner, Jeff Randall, can see him.
Yeah.
And it's very well remembered by people. I remember talking to my mum and dad about it when they started repeating it in the mid-80s, and they very clearly remembered it. And then they remade it in the year 2000 with... Oh, that strange casting decision, I thought, at the time, which was Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer. And I'm still not sure whether it worked or not, that they changed a few things about it. And a little bit, actually, you were mentioning about back references. I noticed in the first couple of episodes there were various back references, like at one point I think they go down a road and it's called Spooner Avenue, which is a reference to, is it Dennis Spooner who wrote the original... was it the original theme music? I get confused. I remember his name was in the opening credits of the original. There were a few little...
The script writer.
Script writer, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, and obviously Vic and Bob, not really known for their acting skills as such.
Yeah, I discovered Randall Hopkirk Deceased around the same time as you. It had been a very important thing for me, and I was dreading it when they announced Vic and Bob were going to be doing, because I had horrible visions of you know, them saying... Oh, have you seen me side of beef, Marty, you know, that sort of thing. But thankfully, they were very restrained. I thought they did very well, although Bob isn't really a dramatic lead actor. I think he'd probably admit that himself. Mm. I think it was just slightly wide of the mark. And I can't understand why, because they had great writers for it, like Mark Gatiss, Gareth Roberts, Jeremy Dyson, great theme music. And, of course, it was written by Charlie Higson, who did a very successful... was it James Bond Jr.
Yeah.
that he did? You know, so everything was there. It just didn't quite come off. I think possibly it seemed a bit like a sort of poor relation to Jonathan Creek, which is the really big sort of kind of oddball fantasy drama at the time, even though, you know, Randall Hopkins seems to be around a lot longer.
They also had a bit of a wild card thrown in there as well. Tom Baker played this character called Wyvern, who was another ghost who was advising Marty, and never really had that in the original.
Yeah,
I was never too sure about
Tom
that.
Baker.
Well, exactly, yeah. It was just a chance to get Tom Baker on being Tom Baker.
Mm.
Yeah. OK, are there any others then that, before we wrap up, that you think are particularly noteworthy?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say a couple of words in defence of the Nigel playing the Magic Roundabout, which gets a really, really massive kicking these days. Basically, the story was that Channel 4 got the rights to some episodes of Magic Roundabout that were never dubbed, and Eric Thompson had died a number of years previously, so Nigel Planer did it instead. And what people forget is it actually went out as part of a very straight-faced, very hard news show on Channel 4. It was an interruption in that, and it's kind of written for adults, lots of jokes about the counterculture and, you know, the Little Red School Book and things like that. And if you... Nigel Planer is, you know, a witty man, and it was... It's actually not that bad if you watch it through those eyes, really. Disastrous one twice was there's a game show called Ask the Family, which was originally presented by Robert Robinson. And the big thing about that was it was very sort of tweedy and quaint in the face of changing times. I mean, famously had lurid psychedelic title graphics and a sitar theme tune, and then, you know, you get Robert Robinson saying, ah, the answer is a video recorder, a device they tell me for recording one program while watching another. What will they think of next? And then they brought it back in 1999 with Alan Titchmarsh, and they concentrated it too much on the Tweedy side. It was just nothing, you know. Within about 2 minutes, you think, this isn't interesting at all, and switch over. So then, more recently, they brought it back with Dick and Dom, who were very, very controversial at the time. So I think that was weighted against it already, but they went in completely opposite direction, made it more zany, and that's a sort of ragga remix of that sitar music, and things like that. A lot of people complained, but they'd just come out of a very bizarre situation where there was an MP called Peter Love who really went for them because he didn't think they were appropriate for children. The more he had to go at them on Dick and Dom in the Bungalow, the more they had to go back at him as the Right Honourable Piece of Fluff MP, which was just a piece of fluff. But I think the knives were out for them, and that's why, apart from being a bit too zany, that's why their Astor family didn't take off.
OK. Anything else just before we wrap up then? Got another couple of minutes?
There was the very, very good BBC 4 remake of the Quatermass Experiment, which was a sort of famous live sci-fi series from the early 50s, where only two of them were actually recorded. It was a six-part series, but during the recording of the second one, a fly landed on the film recorder, and it almost blots out the... It's quite appropriate for Quatermass, really, but it's just a huge fly. There's a picture throughout it, so they didn't bother recording the rest. And,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, there was a film, there was a script book, but this was a live remake using the original scripts, and it actually ran 20 minutes short.
Right.
It did it quicker than expected. And what's interesting about that is a lot of people like David Tennant, Jason Fleming, Indira Varma, who would then go on to be in things like Doctor Who, Torchwood, Primeval. But unfortunately, after that was a success, the same team tried to remake another wiped sci-fi show from the same time, A for Andromeda, which is originally a very modish thing where a computer signal comes from space and sort of builds Julie Christie as a kind of defective android. And, you know, there was kind of a swinging Dolly Bird scientist thing in the 60s. They did it as a sort of dark, grim, bleak modern thing, and it was just very boring, really. And that was the end of that experiment, really, sadly.
OK, well, I'm sure we're all waiting with bated breath to see what the Are You Being Served remake is going to be like. But in the meantime, how can people get hold of you on social media, etc.?
At OutOnBlue6 on Twitter, that's all one word,
yeah.
Or timworthington.blogspot.co.uk.
That's
I actually managed to say it correctly this time as well.
That's where people can read your writings. I can highly recommend it. Yeah. Some interesting articles on there. Thanks very much for your time, Tim. I'm sure we'll have you back on again at some point when we want to talk about TV and cultural stuff. So thanks very much for your time.
Yep.
No problem. So that's Tim Worthington talking about TV remakes.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at TiltUK.
Yes, you're listening to Tilt at the Mill, at the Music Mill. I'm Mark Thompson, here with you for about the next 25 minutes or so. So we've just been talking about television and television remakes. So we're going to switch gear a little bit now and talk about politics. Specifically, I wanted to talk about what's being described as the new politics. So obviously things have changed quite a lot in UK politics, certainly in terms of the Labour Party in the last few months with the election of Jeremy Corbyn. And I think some of the old guard, I mean, Tony Blair made a comment a couple of weeks ago that he basically said he doesn't understand the new politics and he doesn't really understand, you know, how politics is working anymore. But I don't think he's the only politician of long standing that's struggling with this new world. I'm delighted to be joined by Emma Burnell, a Labour activist, who is going to talk to us a little bit about this. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for coming on. Are you struggling with the new politics?
I think lots of people are, particularly people like me who've been around a long time.
And me.
I mean, it's... A lot of it is be careful what you wish for in some ways. I mean, people like me have been saying, oh, we must empower the membership. And that's great, and I still believe that. But the problem is that what's happened is that we have now a very specific new influx of members who have come from very different places and don't necessarily represent the general populace in terms of their opinions.
Mm.
So you've got a real difference of opinion, certainly from what's seen in polling. I mean, we may see that polling is wrong, and certainly it was well out of the general election. Now, it was well out in the opposite direction, so that's one of the big caveats that I put on all the people from my left who tell me, no, no, polling's all wrong, look at what happened at the election.
Mm.
But on the other hand, look at what happened in Michigan just last night. You know, the polls had Hillary Clinton 20 points ahead, at least. And in fact, Bernie Sanders won it. So it's not just in the UK where this is happening to people who have been the established politicians for a long time.
I mean, I think, you know, maybe I'm too long in the tooth, because my concern is a little bit, actually, again, something that Tony Blair referred to, I think it was about 18 months ago in the run-up to the previous general election, where he said, I mean, he was speaking in coded language, but it's kind of clear what he meant. He said something along the lines of, you know, his fear is that you're going to see an election campaign where a traditional left-wing party takes on a traditional right-wing party with a traditional result.
Mm.
And what he meant was he didn't think Ed Miliband could win the election, and it turned out he was right. If Ed Miliband couldn't win, I'm struggling to see how Jeremy Corbyn can win unless the rules of politics have changed in a fundamental way that people like me still haven't realised or understood. That's really about the only way I can see Corbyn becoming Prime Minister.
Well, that's the big gamble, isn't it, that the Labour Party are taking? And, you know, I'm not convinced, but we shall see. I think that in May we'll get local election results, and we'll get some results of in Scotland and Wales. Now, those will probably be first indications of these fundamental questions and whether politics as a whole has changed or whether it's political parties and political activists that have changed. And those are fundamentally two different things, and that's the big question. When political activism runs up against politics, sometimes it can be quite a big shock to the system.
Yeah. I mean, my concern, well, I have a number of concerns, but when it comes to the elections in May, it wouldn't really be fair to blame Corbyn, would it? He's only been in a few months. I mean, political leaders usually get a few election cycles. I mean, maybe Ian Duncan Smith, you know, didn't really, only got a couple of years. But and maybe Corbyn will only get a couple of years. I don't know. I mean, the knives already seem to be out from him from a lot of his parliamentary colleagues. But I personally don't think, even though I struggle to understand how Corbyn could ever become Prime Minister, and I do have some problems with some of his stances, I don't think it would be fair to blame him for what happens in May, whatever happens.
Well, yes and no, Mark. As I understand it, in opposition, at this point in the cycle, Labour has never lost councillors.
Right.
And if we see losses of, well, We see losses in the tens, up to 100. We could probably chalk that up to the fact that we got a pretty good result in this last cycle last time around. But if they're higher than that, then I think, you know, we need to look at what's happened to the Liberal Democrats. And, you know, what started out was an erosion of their activist base because they lost a lot of their councillors. And we saw how disastrous that was for them last year. And I think, you know, Labour has a really, really shoddy record of being able to get rid of leaders that are not working.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people who are going to be nervous that they're going to lose their seats and their jobs, and a lot more people who are going to worry more fundamentally that the point of Labour is not to oppose the Tories from a safe distance, but to work to change the country for the better for the people we're there to represent. And ultimately, if we can't do that in our current formation, then we need to change the formation.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck by something I saw the other day, which was there was some protest march. I forget what it was even about now. It might have been Amnesty or something. And Jeremy Corbyn was on the march. And I just tweeted, I said, why is Jeremy Corbyn going on marches all the time? He's leader of the opposition. He has a more substantial platform now than standing with a megaphone in front of a crowd of a few hundred people shouting about stuff. It just, it feels like that's his modus operandi. That's the way he's always done it. Yeah. And he almost can't help himself.
No, and it's his comfort zone. And there are lots of people who would tell you that the place for the Labour Party leader is at the front of a march. I tell you that the place for the Labour Party leader is in number 10 Downing Street. And we should be spending every single day trying to get Jeremy there, or if not Jeremy, trying to get someone there who can get there.
Mm.
I'm not anti-Corbyn, I'm not pro-Corbyn either. At the moment, I'm very much just, I would like to see the evidence with my own eyes of how this is going to translate into a workable programme for government that the country will accept. I'm sceptical, I'll accept that, but I'm not. I think there are problems both with the pro and anti-Corbyn voices at the moment, that everything is seen through that prism rather than through a much broader prism of how can we build a platform that works for the country. You know, whoever the head of that is doesn't really matter. What matters is getting an electable platform elected.
Yeah. I mean, just to come back to the original premise for a minute, talking about the new politics. Do you think that Corbyn does represent a new politics? And I don't mean this, you know, flippantly or sarcastically, because obviously he's been an MP for a very long time. But do you think he actually does represent a new way of doing politics? Because one of the things that I struggled with at first, I must say I haven't seen as much evidence of this more recently, but he just didn't seem to be very good at politics. He seemed to make some pretty basic tactical errors, and I mean, I think the nadir of this wasn't even him, it was John McDonnell standing at the dispatch box waving Chairman Mao's little red book at George Osborne. I mean,
I think we talked about that last time, Mark. We did, yeah,
so we won't go over that again, but the point is, it just feels like, or felt like at least, they weren't very good at politics. I mean, I'm sure it's a very steep learning curve for them.
Yeah.
But I guess my fear is that although some of it looked a bit kind of amateur hour, that actually, if they professionalise themselves, they'll just eventually become indistinguishable from all the other politicians, which will be the USP. They'll blow their own USP out of the water if they do that, won't they?
I mean, new politics is such an amorphous phrase. It can mean anything anybody wants it to mean.
Mm.
Does it mean being really left-wing and retaining the same views you had 30 years ago? Sometimes, yeah, absolutely. Does it mean engaging people in a new, more dynamic way? Yeah, absolutely that too. Does it, you know, it can mean all sorts of things. I would say that Jess Phillips, for example, who's quite an outspoken critic of Corbyn, is just as indicative of a new way of doing politics as is Jeremy Corbyn himself.
Well, Jess Phillips is, I think, she's rapidly becoming my favourite member of Parliament because she just really wants to do it in a different way. I mean,
yeah.
I think yesterday she stood up in Parliament and read the names of 120 women who'd been murdered by men since the previous International Women's Day. And she got a round of applause from the House of Commons, which is very unusual, doesn't happen that often. And whenever you see her being interviewed...
Well, it's also against the rules of the Commons.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think that's going to change because it's
old politics.
Exactly. It's happened a few times now. And she's exactly the sort of MP who, you know, doesn't care about those sort of rules. But, you know, I think you're right. I think she does represent a very different way of doing politics, of not sounding like a robot, speaking your mind. I think she actually wrote a piece a few days ago where she's kind of highlighted how, you know, that's caused her some problems. It's not easy to break these rules. I mean, I often don't think that these rules are there for a very good reason, but actually to try and move outside of them, you set yourself up, as a target, don't you?
Well, yeah, and absolutely, and you know, there's this endless, we want our politicians to be human. Oh, actually, we don't like them to make mistakes. Mm. You know, it's a real dichotomy that the politicians face, and of course they end up just sounding really cautious and careful, because why wouldn't you if people are ripping your head off every time you do anything?
Mm.
Lots of people get this, and Stella Creasy gets the same, it's really difficult. I mean, to go back to Jeremy Corbyn, his campaign, the way he campaigned for the leader of the Labour Party, was actually really quite inspiring and interesting and new and clever. And the way they got hundreds of thousands of volunteers active, engaged, involved, and they felt active, engaged, involved. They didn't feel like they were just leaflet fodder. They didn't feel like they were just there for the money, you know, to give their £5 or whatever. That was a real achievement, but it just isn't translating from a campaign that was internal to a campaign that is external. And I think part of the problem is that those people who were running it, a lot of them incredibly bright, really good people, but what they have been obsessed over, what they've been interested in for years, is the internal mechanics of the Labour Party. That's what they know about, that's what they care about, that's what they've always known and cared about. And unfortunately, that has not translated into understanding, knowing and caring about the much wider concerns of the general public.
Mm.
So, I mean, if you take the recent, I don't know if you've seen the recent sort of advert with the Google unfair, funfair thing.
No.
But it was about tax avoidance. It was a sort of cleverish pun. At a advert which had about 20 million too many words in it, but I'm a purist that way.
Oh, is this the thing with George Osborne on a Dodger?
George Osborne on a Dodger.
I saw a picture of it. I didn't see the advert, yeah.
And it was, you know, the Tories don't understand what tax unfairness is. Perhaps they ought to Google it or something like that.
Hmm.
Now, it's not a bad concept. I would argue it's not the right concept for local elections.
Hmm.
But it just didn't feel like... It felt like it was a few clever people in a room again. And I'm tired of politics being a few clever people in a room. And I don't care who the clever people are. That's not how you run things.
See, that's very old politics, isn't it? With a clique, a cabal around the leader making all the decisions. I mean, we've seen that time and again. You know, that's one of the problems. I mean, I used to be a Lib Dem, as you know. And that is one of the problems that's now... It's now pretty clear that's what was happening with Nick Clegg and his leadership, that there was just a very tight... sell around him, and you know, they weren't necessarily seeing what everyone else was seeing, even the activists and even the MPs within their own party, because they had their own agenda and they had their own approach to things. And you look back through prime ministers past, you know, John Major with his bunker mentality, Gordon Brown did the same thing, Tony Blair with his sofa government. It's, you know, this pattern repeats itself over and over again, doesn't it?
It does, and you know, it's to the detriment, because the more you go into yourselves, the less you hear the general public and the less you hear good ideas from unusual places. And, you know, I would say that part of the downfall of Blair and the turnaround in his fortunes was that his circle got smaller and smaller.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Blair's problems, there were various problems in Iraq and that, but I think after Alistair Campbell left, he really struggled, because he never really found someone to replace him, although, you know, Campbell, again, that was part of his very inner clique, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, but he was also clever enough to go outside it.
Mm.
And Blair was. You know, Blair used to meet with Dennis Skinner on a weekly basis, two people who had less in common I cannot imagine.
Mm.
But, you know, they both knew that they were part of the broad Labour tradition and that it was important that they talked to each other.
Is Jeremy Corbyn weekly meeting with Peter Mandelson? Because that would be the equivalent, wouldn't it?
That would be the equivalent, not that I've been told. Mm. Not that anyone tells me anything.
Yeah. I do actually wonder if maybe Corbyn needs to do something like that. I mean, maybe not that, but something to just demonstrate that he is actually reaching across the internal aisle within the Labour Party.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see, say, for example, Jeremy Corbyn speaking at the Progress Conference, Progress being the very, very avowedly Blairite think tank.
Yeah.
You know, if Jeremy Corbyn went to... And I'm sure they'd have him. And that would be interesting. And Jeremy Corbyn being questioned by a Progress audience would be fascinating. Equally, were that to happen, I would like to see someone from the right do a similar thing and reach out to the other side and go to Momentum meetings. We should be talking to each other. At the moment, both parties, the Labour and Conservative parties, both feel like they're not one party. Europe is ripping the Tories apart, and you're just constantly infighting at the moment. We've been infighting since September. And it just feels like, you've got to some days wake up and remember why we're all in the same party.
Yeah, I mean, the Labour Party exists in order to try and gain power and to be the government, and that's a world that's very alien to Corbyn. So it will be interesting to see how it plays out over the course of the next few years if he's given that opportunity. I mean, I suppose, I have written and talked about for years about, how the old ways of doing politics don't work and, we need a new approach. And, even things like, collective cabinet responsibility, I think, is abused in our system so that everyone just ends up sounding like robots. And, maybe if that could be loosened and so on and so forth. And I think Corbyn tried a little bit of that and then it kind of didn't work. And, there's aspects of what he's trying that I'm willing him on. But at the same time, again, maybe I'm too old. Maybe I'm too dyed in the tooth. Maybe I've just been observing and involved in this stuff for too long to be able to see a different way of doing it. And, there's a part of me that hopes I'm wrong and that actually Corbyn is actually able to do well electorally and prove that you don't have to do things in the old way. But maybe a little bit like yourself, I remain to be convinced is probably the most charitable way I can put
it. There is an interesting question is Corbyn, if he does fail, I'm not saying he will, I think there's plenty of things going to happen between now and the next election which could well work in not to the government's favour, let's put it that way. I mean, the economy's slowing down again for a start.
Yeah.
If we have another major crash, that throws everything up in the air. But the question is not, it's not if Corbyn fails, therefore it should go back to how it was.
Yeah.
I don't think either of them are necessarily the right.
It's going to be that's going to be the default assumption, though,
and
isn't it?
And that will be the default, and it'll be very, very hard not to default into that.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do or the answer.
Mm. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, you mentioned the Tories' EU travails a couple of minutes ago, and that just in the last few minutes, maybe if we could just turn our attention to that. How do you think things have gone since Cameron came back from his renegotiation and the campaign has started in earnest?
Well, I think Cameron's renegotiation didn't go terribly well for him.
Mm.
I'm very much in favour of staying in Europe. I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. I don't think Cameron's deal was ever going to be my deal breaker, no matter what he came back with. But I don't think it was enough for him to sort his own internal politics and problems out. And that's what he really needed to come back with. It wasn't come back with something that would convince the country. It was come back with something that would convince more Tory MPs than he's managed. And I think he's been really shocked and surprised by how split, by how many Tory MPs are now going for the outside.
Yeah, but if the Tory party was ever going to have a nervous breakdown, it was going to be about this issue, wasn't it? So really, shouldn't he have seen it coming?
You and I have been saying this for a while. That doesn't mean that Cameron saw this coming. I think he thought he had it managed better.
I think he overestimates his own ability to be able to pull it out of the fire at the last minute, though. Because he's done it before on numerous occasions.
Absolutely. Well, I remember when he came back and he sort of vetoed something that wasn't really a veto and everyone was like, oh, Cameron, you're amazing. And 10 minutes later, he had to declare a referendum because that's how it works. He gets short-term wins and long-term losses. And I'm very concerned that one of the long-term losses he might get is our status in Europe.
Well, I mean, that's interesting you say that. Are you detecting that it's possible that we might go for out? Because
I can't call this one at all.
Really?
Because if I can't call it, then it's really quite considerably closer than anyone expected it to be.
Why do you think that is, though? Because up until recently, it seemed pretty, well, very, very likely that the country would vote to remain. Do you think things are just starting to turn as a result of the campaign, as a result of maybe Boris? Do you think he might have turned a few heads?
I don't think it's Boris at all. I think Boris is irrelevant on this one. And I think Boris is actually making a bit of a fool of himself. No, I think there is a genuine mood against status quos at the moment. And I think that turnout's going to be very low. And I think the people who will turn out are the people who really care. And I think the people who really care more often than not, are you a sceptic?
That's an interesting point, because, yeah, the older you are, the more likely you are to vote, and the older you are, the more likely you are to vote out, as far as I can tell. Here, because, I mean, I guess the oldest voters are the people who can remember what it was like before we were even part of the EEC, and they'll look back at that and think, well, things weren't too bad then. It's not as frightening for them as it might be for, say, someone who's in their 20s or 30s who's never known anything other than being part of a, you know, economic and, to an extent, political union.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we'll actually return to the Europe of the 1950s. But
no, no matter what Nigel Farage might want.
But exactly, yeah.
Hmm.
Be careful what you wish for Nigel Farage. If he does win this, I think that's it's going to burn him harder than anyone else.
Yeah, well, he says that it's what he's always wanted, but actually, I think what he'd prefer is for it to be out, but for it to remain, but for it to be quite close, so that that gives his party a raison d'être. Well, exactly, they can do an SNP then, and then maybe win some more seats, and you know he can remain leader until he resigns again, and then unresigns again in a few years' time. You've slightly surprised me here by saying that you think that it's on a knife edge. The feeling I've been detecting is that it's probably still pretty solidly for Remain, but one of the problems with referenda is once the cat's out the bag, you don't know what's going to happen, and often people don't necessarily vote for what's on the ballot paper. I mean, if you look back to the AV referendum, which I still bear the scars of, I mean, that was ostensibly a vote on what electoral system we wanted to use for Westminster, but it appeared to be about whether you liked Nick Clegg, about whether you thought he was a liar, and about what he'd done on tuition fees, which, you know...
I think you might be slightly over-egging that, because you were so desperate.
Maybe, but it wouldn't at all surprise me if there's some kind of migrant crisis in the middle of June that's got up by the tabloid press because, you know, they want... Some of them want to go out, and they'll really push that. You know, people going into the ballot, putting their ex on the ballot paper, you know, if that's really raging during the summer, people could be voting on something that's actually quite a short-term issue, on something that's going to affect this country for decades. But that is one of the problems with referenda.
Yeah. And, you know, the other problem, of course, with referenda, as we've absolutely seen in Scotland, is that having an answer doesn't mean you have an end to it.
Yeah, the old neverendum.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. If it is very, very close, like let's say it's 52-48 in favour of Remain, that won't settle anything.
No. I mean, it was 45-55 in Scotland, which, you know, good 10-point margin that will settle anything. And we're still talking about a second referendum, you know, certainly within my lifetime.
Yeah, well...
Probably within the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, Boris was even flirting with the possibility of using the fact that, you know, if we vote out as a means of trying to get a better deal, and then we can have a second referendum to see if we could vote in again. But I think he's backed off from that because he's realised that it's nonsense. Well, yeah, it's, you know, if we're out, we're out. I think Cameron's absolutely right in that. If we vote to go out politically, that'll be it. You know, there's people who've wanted this referendum for decades and decades. They finally got the referendum. If they vote out and then within 2 years we're having another one, see if we can go back in again, that won't wash. This is a once-in-a-generation thing. I don't think we'll see another referendum on Europe in my lifetime, however long that may be.
Well, if we go out, we won't. Because
that's what I mean.
We won't be allowed back in.
No, if we go out, we won't see another one. If we vote in, we might well see another one within 5 or 10 years. Yeah.
And it's not going away. They're not going to suddenly go, okay then, the will of the people has spoken. I don't care about this issue that I've been banging on about for the last 25 years anymore.
Okay. Good stuff. Well, thanks for coming on, Emma. People can get you on Twitter. Is it at @EmmaBurnell_?
That's me, yeah.
And also, you used to write for Labour List?
I'm now EmmaBurnell.org.
EmmaBurnell.org.
Where you can see my very rude comedy as well as my political writing.
Good stuff. Well, I'll have to check that out because I wasn't aware of that new URL, so I will have a look at that. But thanks very much for your time tonight, Emma. It's been a very, very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Good stuff. That's Emma Burnell, who's a Labour activist. We've been talking about the new politics and also what's happening to do with the EU referendum. Well, thanks very much for listening tonight. I'm Mark Thompson. You've been listening to Tilt at the Mill. We talked to Tim Worthington about TV remakes and also to Emma Burnell about the new politics and also the EU referendum. I'm here every fortnight, so I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time talking about topical issues and cultural issues as well. You can tweet me at Mark Reckons and also tweet the show at TiltUK. You can email me markreckons@live.co.uk. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in a couple of weeks.